The comic shows a little stick figure typing away at the computer. From outside the frame, someone says, "Are you coming to bed?" "I can't," the stick figure responds. "Someone is wrong on the internet." It's a funny cartoon, and it captures my life pretty accurately. I spend a lot of time arguing on the internet, and sometimes there's no point to it. Sometimes, though, there is a point. We know that education and awareness matter because sometimes it's not just that something is wrong on the internet, but that something is wrong in the world. Sometimes you can't just go to bed because just going to bed means leaving people behind. In the words of E.B. White, "I wake each morning torn between the desire to save the world and to savor it. It makes it hard to plan my day." What will you do with your one wild and precious life, in the words of the poem we just heard? Will you read the news, post articles on social media, or wander through the fields contemplating who made the black bear and the swan? Will you write letters to your representatives? Will you spend the afternoon gazing at a grasshopper, feeling idle and blessed? Will you complain to your best friends about what a tragedy the world is becoming, and if only other people cared and were as good as citizens as you are, everything would be fine? I lean towards that last one myself. I catch myself in these conversations all the time. I've been working on building wisdom in how I spend my one wild and precious life in person and online. I've been working on a practice of waiting to wade in on something until I've figured out if I'm really needed in that conversation and if chiming in really is a good use of my time. I've been learning to avoid that story I tell myself about how the world needs me to chime in the name of building awareness. And what I'm trying to learn is how to tell the difference between speaking up that's effective and speaking up that feels effective but doesn't create lasting change. I've spent my whole life in this journey in one way or another. And I draw on Unitarianism and Universalism for guidance in this. I love that we have a culture of working for social change. At the same time, though, it's not the only place I've looked. I've taken trainings, I've planned and participated in policy campaigns and political ones, I've done big crowdfunding things and viral videos and worked on getting people out of jail, and I've done more media work than makes any reasonable sense given my actual level of expertise on any of the topics I was talking about. And I've done direct action work, and especially direct work partnering with people experiencing poverty and violence to help them work their way out of those cycles. And over time in all this, I've put together a kind of How to Change the World guerrilla handbook, and it doesn't say what I imagined that it might. It's best explained using a series of stories. The first story I want to tell you is about Reverend Fougence, who many of you know. He's preached here many times. Years ago, Fougence came on a visit from Burundi to Saskatoon and got to know my son Eric. They spoke French together, and Eric made jokes about me and thought I couldn't understand him. Fougence and I bonded, too, talking about social action causes and how to use one's first-world assets to create meaningful change. We raised a bit of money for the church Fougence founded in Burundi, and he went home. A year later, I learned from Facebook that Fougence was in grave danger. The Unitarian Church of Burundi had been documenting human rights abuses, being supportive of LGBTQ people, and generally speaking out in ways that the government didn't want. People came and shot bullets into the walls of the church, and Fougence was kidnapped and then arrested. As I read about this, I blurted this story in horror to Gary, my kids' father, who was sitting beside me on the couch, and I looked up to see my son Eric sitting there too, his face draining of color. "But Fougence didn't do anything," Eric said. "I know," and I started to explain, "but we have to do something," Eric interrupted with great fervor, and I didn't know what to tell him. There's this formula you use in activism. You isolate the change you want, in this case, for Fougence to be free. You figure out who has the power to make that change, in this case, the government of Burundi, and then you figure out what you control that that power cares about. In this case, that last step was a little tricky because the government of Burundi doesn't usually consult me on any of their decisions. But public opinion of the West does matter to African countries. I just wasn't sure it would matter enough. I didn't want to put my kids' hopes on the line for such a long shot, and I didn't want to put my own hopes on the line either. But it turned out I didn't have a choice. Eric began a letter-writing campaign. He got nearly half a dozen kids in his class to help. Concerned that this might not be enough to sway the government of Burundi, he learned to program, and then he made a website where he gathered all the press releases and photos of Fougence and information forms he and I had created for people to take to church. We made handouts and Dropbox folders and published links to petitions and Facebook groups. And Eric sat on the computer gleefully watching the views on his site pile up. They were in the dozens and then the hundreds, and he was sure that the governor of Burundi couldn't fail to notice what hundreds of people were saying. As this was happening, his dad began looking more and more uncomfortable. His dad has lived in Africa and has some experiences with governments like the ones in Burundi. Undaunted, Eric pressed on. So did someone in the Philippines who created a Facebook page and a petition, someone pretty high in international development in some Unitarian Universalist organizations in the U.S. joined in. Eventually I received a letter filled with lies about what a terrible person Fulgence was and all the money he'd embezzled. I waved it around the kitchen, angrily declaring that they were trying to smear him, and stared at Gary in disbelief as the corners of his mouth turned up in a slight smile. "How can you be smiling at this?" I demanded. "They wrote back," he said, "which means they care what you think. Figure out who can create the change you want. Figure out what you control that they care about." And they were caring. We won. A qualified victory that involved Fulgence on a temporary release, speeding for the Rwandan border without saying goodbye to anyone. He made it to Canada, and his family now lives here with him. That's one of the stories Eric tells when you ask him about why he is a Unitarian. It's the story Fulgence tells, too. He talks about sitting in his jail cell, knowing that people were working around the world on his behalf, and the image of the flame of a chalice burning bright in his mind. That first principle of activism 101 is very simple. Know what change you want. Know who can make it happen. Know what you control that they care about. The example of Fulgence and Eric is a simple illustration, but it turns out it's almost never that clear cut, because in reality, this recipe is very hard to follow in practice. Because what we want to do, what we're drawn to doing, is talking to our people, the people who are already convinced, talking to them about how big the problems are or how unempathetic the bad guys are. Sometimes we argue with them about finer points of exactly how we should be proceeding, or we craft and refine resolutions without thinking about whether or not those resolutions will be read or acted upon. This is a comfortable exercise, but it doesn't create change. When we do approach people outside our tribe, too, we sometimes do it without thinking over what we control that they care about. I remember hearing about one of the UU ministers in a big church in BC meeting Stephen Harper and telling him that the Unitarians were upset with Harper's government. Harper, apparently, raised his eyebrow and said, "Ah, Unitarians. Remind me again, how many of you are there in Canada?" The message was clear. Unitarians are a tiny voting bloc, and not one that Harper was hoping to win over anyways. Which, by the way, I think is unfortunate. I'm not going to argue politics specifically here, but what I will say is that I wish we were a more politically diverse group. Without that diversity, we fall into a trap of thinking of people as others and writing stories about why they think and act as they do. The most extreme versions of a position are always the ones that get the most media attention. So if you rely on media rather than relationship, it's easy to start thinking of others as stereotypes of themselves. And that makes it hard to be strategic. I was once part of a campaign to push for a comprehensive poverty reduction strategy from a conservative government here in Saskatchewan. And I remember in one meeting, we were talking about how we needed political support from all parts of the spectrum. We held a lot of conversations to figure out what people very different from us politically thought about poverty. And we learned that they care about the poor a great deal, but have a strong sense of fiscal responsibility that sometimes prevents action. So we built a data-driven campaign focusing on the costs of poverty, ER visits, ambulance calls, addiction programs, police involvements, jail stays. We proved that the cost of a poverty reduction strategy was less than the cost of not having one, and we swayed a diverse voter base so that we had the control of something that the politicians cared about. It was not so much an act of forcing their hand, by the way, as it was of providing them political support they needed to do things that were reasonable and sound choices. Often, our ability to create change is directly linked to our ability to build relationship with and have empathy with people with whom we disagree. Creating change is also, of course, about gathering your usual supporters. But that's less about getting people to agree with you as it is about convincing them to lend part of their one wild and precious life to your cause. And to do that, they need to believe that change is possible. They need to have hope. Which brings me to the second law of social action, which is to think in terms of lists. There's a saying, which is that every campaign is a list-building exercise. To show you what I mean, I'll take you back to Fulgence's story. He was freed, he made it to Canada, he got refugee status. To be a minister in North America, he would need enough to live for 2 years with his family while doing the things needed for UU minister credentialing. We decided to crowdfund, and I believe some of you participated in that project. It was, to the best of my knowledge, the largest sum crowdfunded in UU history, which I like to pretend is because of my brilliant strategy, but it's not that, not even a little. The reason that campaign was so successful was because of the work done to get Fulgence out of jail. Eric's work, sure, and the work of the person in the Philippines who started that petition when Fulgence was in jail, and another person who started a Facebook group to coordinate efforts to get him out. When the time came to raise funds, we had a list already prepared. We had people who cared about Fulgence, who had already done work on his behalf, who had the experience of coming together and accomplishing something life-changing in Fulgence's life. We had a sense of our power as a group. We were ready to donate, to share the campaign, to ask family and friends, and that's why it was so successful, because it started from a strong list. Changing the world is, at its foundation, a list-building exercise. When you do the math of who can make change and what you control that they care about, the list matters. Being part of a solid list is how you control things that decision-makers care about. Petitions to change laws are about lists. Fundraising is about lists. Celebrity, people watching Last Week Tonight with comedian John Oliver, then calling their local representatives to demand change based on what they saw, that's about lists. Elections are about building the list of people you need to make sure to get to the polls. Many things that appear to be direct social action, petitions being a big one for this, are often not as much about effectiveness in that one campaign as about building lists over time. Religion in political spheres, well, that's one of the greatest list-making vehicles in all of history. List is an inadequate word, though, and it's a bit of an icky one, because it's not just about names in a database, it's about relationship and community. And it's about coming together to be part of something greater than you could have been on your own. It's about a sense of belonging and identity and joy and fun. And that's key. People become a part of your community because you offer something. Hope, fun, and belonging. A few times ago when I was here, I spoke to you about Natasha and Celeste, who built a front porch and spent a ton of time on it, and over the course of a couple years turned their street into a giant multi-generational community center. I also told you about the campaign they ran to raise tens of thousands of dollars to build a well in Celeste's home village in Kenya. What I didn't tell you about was the connection between those two things. How Natasha built over time a community of people who barbecued together and took casseroles over when people were sick and held dance parties and talked about the society they wanted to live in together. And so when she wanted to do something big, she didn't just have a list around her, she had an army. To look at a big version of this, you can look at the Obama campaign. At a workshop we took from the people who ran that, they explained how fundamental community was to their success. And this was tricky, because they began that campaign drawing on a base of people that were delusioned about the world. Everyone had a list of things that were wrong as long as your arm and a sense of despair that those things could be changed. And the problem with despair is you don't build action on it. You can build action on anger, but not on despair, because momentum needs hope. The Obama people built a creative campaign focused on hope. In the workshop they held for us, they asked us to think about our values, and then to think about a story about a change point in our life where we made a choice to live out those values. And we told our stories back and forth, and we workshopped them, and we learned how to tell our story and to connect it to the values we were sharing with the person we're talking to, and then, most importantly, to connect those things to the action that we wanted people to take. Values, story, action. You need all three. Without values, you just have a story and an action. That's a marketing campaign for fancy sneakers. Without a story, you just have values and an action. So imagine if I'd gotten up here giving you all the information I've given you this morning with no stories attached. It would be a lecture. You'd forget it within 10 minutes, if you were listening in the first place. You also can't do this without action, because just values and a story is a common mistake, and it's a damaging one. When we connect with people about values, talk about stories that move them deeply, we stir them up. And if you don't have an action to go with that, then there's nowhere for that momentum to go. So it circles back into a sense of hopelessness and then despair. You need action to draw people together. For whatever you want to do in this moment and for the list you want to build for what you'll want to do later. But which actions? Like, what are the actions that work to build community? There are two things to think about here. The first is the activist saying that you need to pick something that is big enough to matter and small enough to win. That's crucial. Big enough to matter, small enough to win. The second thing I ask myself is, who am I reaching for? For me, I'm prone, as I've said before, to social media rage on the internet, so I've learned to really watch myself to avoid campaigns that are outrage-based. Outrage-based campaigns are effective, but in my view, they also isolate people into camps, which reduces effectiveness in the long term. Sure, you build a list of people who want to be involved with what you're doing, but you build a list of the type of people who are drawn to outrage and non-complex thinking. So I try hard to avoid campaigns that divide people into good guys and bad guys and make fun of the humanity of people and who make fun of the people whose humanity we've forgotten. So let me give you an example of me mostly failing at this. A couple of years ago, my youngest son, Anthony, was going through a gender fluid stage. He was never transgender, but he was so set on wearing pink and playing with ponies and being a big ball of sparkle and jazz that I wondered. And I was afraid of how the world, a world with pretty set definitions of what makes a good man, would treat Anthony. At the time, there was this big news story of a woman in Alberta who made a rap video saying that transgender kids should be denied certain rights, that they were only transgender because of absentee fathering and abuse and a bunch of other nonsense. And she called on religious people to speak up in support of her message. I was furious, partly because the rap was genuinely cruel and partly because I had my own mama bear stuff coming into play. So I wrote a parody rap, which was easy to do because this woman was a terrible rapper. And it was witty and it was cruel and it would get social media attention. And I thought it would be great to publish it and take all the wind right out of her sails. It was the boys' dad who stopped me. He asked me who I was reaching for. And I had to stop and think, because the video I was preparing wasn't a reach, it was a punch. It would make me feel good, and it would make the people who agreed with me feel good, and it would make the people who disagreed with me feel small. It wouldn't change their minds, really, just make them feel small. And as for actual trans kids, it might make them feel better, but for the most part, I think they'd have felt caught in the crossfire or ignored. I wasn't speaking to them, after all. I was speaking to her. When I showed the woman's video to Anthony, he was confused. He didn't understand her view on religion as a place to rally support against transgender kids. His experience of religion was that church was the first place where he could be himself without any fear. And he wanted trans kids to know that places like that existed and that they deserved one of their own. This lady, even though she was in the news, was not really relevant to him. The kids who had heard her message and been misinformed by it, they were who mattered. He knew who he was reaching for. We invited congregations across Canada to reach with us. We told Anthony's story to people and invited them to respond. Values, story, action. We asked people to send in photos of themselves with signs saying what they would say to trans kids looking for community. Unitarians across Canada gathered in droves and wrote the most wonderful messages, and the video was heartwarming. And it did make it to the news, but more than that, I still hear from kids who were touched by it. I still hear from Unitarians who found it meaningful to participate, to be part of an action that was big enough to matter, small enough to win, and that reached for someone. So when I say list building exercise, that's what I mean. That and the potlucks at Natasha's house and the church services on Sunday, and walks looking at grasshoppers too, because if we allow ourselves to skimp on those moments, we become joyless. Becoming joyless, that makes us exhausted and less brave. And then we're prone to doing things that make us feel good but aren't effective. We're prone to sniping and endlessly crafting resolutions. We don't have to choose between savoring the world and saving it, because people who savor the world are list builders. So we need to be effective and joyful, not just because that's how we want to spend our one wild and precious life, but because maintaining a sense of joy isn't an alternative to social action. It's the foundation of it. Know the change you want, who can make that change, and what you control that they care about. Think in terms of lists, joyful, interconnected, diverse community. Pick things that are big enough to matter and small enough to win. Focus on who you're reaching for, not who you feel like punching at. And above all, be joyful. Above all, make space for your wild and precious life.